For some, the American dream is owning land. But if a pipeline is planned across your property,
as it turns out, these companies, these corporations can just come and take it away from you.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the fight against eminent domain in fracking country. And we look at the rise and fall of another fossil fuel, coal.
A lot of coal, a little coal.
It's a musical. Plus, winged creatures with big red eyes are about to invade our region. And some people are delighted about it.
It's kind of like walking through some sort of fairy-filled landscape. It's pretty cool.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pipelines. They crisscross the countryside and lie scattered beneath the urban landscape. They bring us water, natural gas, and gasoline. But what if someone came knocking on your door and wanted to put a pipeline through your front yard? State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips takes a look at how eminent domain has entered the fracking debate.
We begin with Elise Gerhardt, sitting up in a white pine tree on a platform about 40 feet high as chainsaws were roaring around her.
This is my home. You know, I grew up here. My parents owned this place 5 years before I was born.
Down below, police officers were guarding work crews and arresting her mother on her own land. So, what's going on here? This is eminent domain in action. The idea that the government can take land for the public good. That's why we, the public, get to enjoy national parks and drive on highways. But companies, and this comes as a surprise to many people, companies sometimes get the authority to take away private land. It certainly came as a shock to Elise Gerhardt.
It boggles my mind because it kind of goes against everything that you're taught, you know, growing up in America, and the American dream is to like own property. And as it turns out, these companies, these corporations can just come and take it away from you.
Right now, Sunoco wants 3 acres of the Gerhardt family land in Huntington County to expand a pipeline that will send natural gas flowing out of the Marcellus Shale 350 miles across Pennsylvania to the company's terminal near Philadelphia. At first, Sunoco said its plan was to export the gas to Scotland so it can be turned into plastics, which has Elise Gerhardt and some of her neighbors asking, what's the public good in chopping down her trees to make plastics overseas?
The world doesn't need more plastic, it needs more forests, bottom line.
When Sunoco officials were confronted with fierce opposition, their story changed. Now they're saying the pipe will benefit rural Pennsylvanians. Their new plan is to also unload some of the fuel along the way to help heat homes in Berks and Lebanon counties. The Gerhardts say Sunoco offered them $100,000 for 3 acres of their land, but they turned it down, saying it wasn't for sale.
Sunoco is a private for-profit corporation. They're not PennDOT widening a road that then we drive on. There's just no comparison here between this and that.
Sunoco wouldn't do a recorded interview for this story, but a spokesman says the company uses the power of eminent domain as a last resort when negotiations with individual landowners break down. And some landowners are happy with the money Sunoco paid them for their land and trees. But dozens of families, including the Gerhardts, are now in county-level courts across the state, either unhappy with the money Sunoco offered or battling the use of eminent domain for something they don't see serving the public good. And it's not just Sunoco. Pipeline companies are taking people to court all across the state.
It's totally insane what's happening. And nothing is sacred, like no conservation area, no business, no home, no school. They'll put these pipelines anywhere they want.
Ellen Gerhardt, Elise's mother, says the family bought the land more than 30 years ago with the intention of preserving it.
You can get up in the morning sometimes and look out your window and you've got deer in the front yard, you've got turkeys with their chicks. You know, it's just a nice, peaceful, quiet area.
Sunoco's power to use eminent domain in this case goes all the way back to a decision made by the state's Public Utility Commission in 1930. And for the most part, county courts have ruled in favor of Sunoco. But recently, a few courts have questioned that 86-year-old decision. And some eminent domain attorneys say the issue may not be resolved until it reaches the state Supreme Court. If so, it will be the job of the court to decide just how broad the power of eminent domain is in the state and how the public good is defined. Eminent domain attorney Rich Raiders represents about a dozen landowners who have cases with Sunoco, including the Gerhardts. Raiders boils it down to this.
The issue for the landowners is that this is David versus Goliath, and unfortunately, as a landowner, you are playing the role of David. And oh, by the way, Goliath is holding the slingshot.
In fact, Sunoco's eminent domain authority has allowed it to chop down trees even as the court battles continue. And while Gerhardt was able to save that one white pine tree she sat in, Sunoco crews did cut down 3 acres of trees.
We had tried everything else. We tried to make petitions and write letters and make phone calls and do research and go to meetings and fight it in the court system, and everything has failed us.
Now, Gerhardt is also worried about the safety of the pipeline that would run beneath her parents' land. Gerhardt's fears have grown since last month when a natural gas interstate transmission line exploded in rural western Pennsylvania, leaving one man with burns on 75% of his body and scorching 40 acres of farmland.
It seems crazy, right? That we have to do this.
Sunoco plans to begin construction on the pipeline this summer. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Natural gas has been at the center of the national conversation about curbing climate change. The Environmental Protection Agency just finalized a rule to reduce the potent greenhouse gas methane from oil and gas operations. To find out more, I'm joined by Grace Hood. She's an energy reporter with Colorado Public Radio. Grace, what are EPA's new regulations for limiting methane at oil and gas operations, and how significant are they for reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, the key thing to keep in mind with these rules is that it deals with new and modified facilities. Really, the keystone of this new rule is that it kind of focuses on leak detection and repair. You know, I think a lot of environmentalists are happy with it, but they also say, well, hey, the majority of leaks come from existing sites. And that's a rule that the EPA is just now looking at developing.
Does EPA really know how much methane is actually leaking from either new or existing oil and gas operations?
Right now, I think it's a little bit of a moving target. We did see the greenhouse gas inventory was revised by the EPA, and they upwardly revised it quite a bit to reflect that there's a lot more methane leaking from oil and gas sites than previously thought. But it seems like we keep encountering more and more research. For example, the Environmental Defense Fund just released a pretty comprehensive survey that they had done of oil and gas fields, and they found quite a bit more methane leaking from oil and gas equipment than they had estimated in previous studies they had done.
Now, Colorado was the first state to limit methane emissions from oil and gas. What have we learned from how these types of rules have been implemented there?
Quite a few things. Colorado implemented its rule about 2 years ago, and it was something that both industry and environmental groups came together on. I think the data is just starting to come out around that, but state regulators have said that they've seen about a 75% decline in the number of sites that need to be addressed. And the impetus in Colorado really was, we're a higher elevation here and we have some issues with ozone and being in compliance with EPA ozone rules. When Colorado put its rule in place 2 years ago, the rule dealt with both new and existing well sites.
So is it stricter than the EPA's rules?
Colorado's regulations are stricter in one sense, and that has to do with the number of required inspections. So Colorado has this tiered structure where they estimated the amount of emissions, and so a larger producing facility, you imagine, would have more potential methane emissions and potential for leaks. So those largest sites require monthly inspections, whereas EPA has a little bit different of a structure where, you know, a lot of the sites see inspections at least twice per year. And, you know, the one thing that Colorado has really learned is that leaks happen. The key thing is getting inspectors, getting oil and gas companies out in the field to detect those leaks and fix them. And a lot of times it's pretty easy to put those fixes in place.
The oil and gas industry in Pennsylvania is scaling back a bit because of the low price of gas. And the industry has said that these new regulations, like the ones that Governor Tom Wolf has proposed here, will be too expensive and will hurt domestic production. Is that a fair assessment?
You know, I think that's really up for debate. You talk to oil and gas companies in Colorado, at least some of the bigger companies that I've talked with, and I think that they're pretty happy with the way the state rule has played out. I think they also say that they want to keep regulation at the state level. They don't want federal regulation. But in Colorado, I think it came down to about $40 million across all the different sizes of companies to implement the new rule. And when I talked to the kind of head honcho at the state, he said that he hadn't really heard a lot of complaints since the state started implementing the rule about costs.
Well, it does save them money to reduce leaks, right?
Exactly. And I think that's part of the calculus in Colorado. Because methane is such a huge part of natural gas, and preventing leaks means more product in the pipeline. So it does benefit oil and gas companies to put some of these elements in place.
Well, Grace, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Grace Hood covers energy and environment for Colorado Public Radio. And our own Reed Frazier has been on assignment this week in north central Pennsylvania. He's been hot on the trail of some researchers who are trying to get a handle on how much methane is leaking from Pennsylvania gas operations. We'll be hearing more about that in upcoming weeks. And there's more on methane at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. Often we go out into nature to seek tranquility, a sense of peace. Think babbling brooks and gentle breezes. But some new arrivals might change that in southwestern Pennsylvania over the next month.
They have the same, produce the same level of sound as a jackhammer, between 100 and 120 decibels, so they make quite the racket.
Later on the Allegheny Front, get ready, it's cicada time. It only happens every 17 years, so stay tuned. While natural gas production is still moving along, if slowly, America's coal industry is hurting. Bad. A majority of the country's big coal companies have filed for bankruptcy, and coal production is at a 30-year low. To understand just how stark that drop-off is, Inside Energy's Jordan Werfs Brock tries an experiment.
Okay, let's take coal production data from the Energy Information Administration and play a single musical note for each week. The higher the pitch of that note, the higher the coal production. This sound represents how much coal came out of the ground in coal's single best week ever, 24 million tons in February 2006. This sound is one of coal's worst weeks, 11 million tons in April 2016. A lot of coal, a little coal. If we string the sounds together, again with each note representing one week, it sounds like this. An audio history of U.S. coal at 10 weeks a second. Okay, in the 80s, we were coming off the 1970s energy crisis and the newly updated Clean Air Act. Production? Chugging along. It sounded like this. You can hear how Cole's song is all over the place, some up weeks, some down weeks. Then, cheap, low-sulfur Wyoming coal burst onto the scene. During the 90s, production soared. Hear how the overall tone is higher than before? In the 2000s, America built tons of homes, which needed lots of electricity. Natural gas prices were high, making burning coal the most economic way to fuel the housing boom. And in 2008, coal reached a peak, averaging 23 million tons a week. Then everything changed. Natural gas took off, and it was cheap. Old coal-fired power plants were retired and replaced with natural gas and renewables. Coal has been up and down since 2010, but you can hear more downs than ups. And in the past year, it fell off a virtual cliff. Once again, here's coal production at its peak in 2008 and in the past 6 months. For coal, it's back to the 1980s. What took 3 decades to build up has taken a year to undo. For Inside Energy, I'm Jordan Werfsbrock.
With the loss of coal production comes the loss of coal jobs. In Kentucky, more than 10,000 coal workers have been laid off since 2008. But some businesses see that as an opportunity. As Erica Peterson reports, they're turning former coal workers into code workers.
All over eastern Kentucky, you see cars and pickup trucks with black license plates proclaiming the owner is a friend of coal. Even though the license plates are all over, it's getting harder to find actual coal miners here. Fewer than 6,000 remain. Many have had to leave the area to find work, but a few have found employment in other, and sometimes unexpected, fields.
Realization I had was that the coal miner, although we think of him as a person who gets dirty and works with his hands, really coal mines today are very sophisticated, and they use a lot of technology, a lot of robotics.
Rusty Justice is one of the owners of BitSource, a year-old tech startup in Pikeville. He owns another company in eastern Kentucky, too, an engineering and excavation firm that relies on the coal industry for most of its business. But with an eye on his bottom line, a few years ago, Justice felt he had to diversify. And after lots of research, he and his business partner settled on coding, tapping the region's workforce of laid-off coal miners and teaching them a new skill. He put up ads and got close to 1,000 applicants. 10 were hired and 9 remain. Inside BitSource's headquarters, the 9 web developers sit around MacBooks writing code. All of them used to work in the coal industry. And after 22 weeks of company-provided training, 6 former coal miners and 3 industry support workers became coders.
I'm Garland Couch, and I'm a developer here at BitSource.
Couch used to be a maintenance manager for coal companies until he lost his job in 2014. Like most coal industry jobs, his paid well. Before he got the call from BitSource, Couch says he figured he'd have to leave the region to support his family.
The entire Appalachian area, if you're not working in the coal industry, then the wage that you're going to make is substantially reduced. If you're going to earn a decent living, then you're having to look to move.
Eastern Kentuckians value family and the area, and they want to stay home, and they should be able to do that. And I think that's our goal as policymakers, to ensure that they can.
State Senator Robin Webb represents several eastern Kentucky counties and is a former coal miner turned lawyer. In the past, politicians focused on improving the region's asphalt infrastructure, building 2- and 4-lane highways to eastern Kentucky. They blamed the struggling economy on the topography, mountains and forests that necessitated spiderweb networks of long, winding roads. But now, BitSource manager John Hanshew says for companies like his to thrive, eastern Kentucky needs a different type of infrastructure.
We aren't shipping coal out of here anymore. We're shipping code. And the broadband's our highway, you know, our shipping lanes, our trains.
The region's internet speeds lag when compared to most other cities, though a state-funded project is working to bring broadband to the region. Leaders in the area see the project as crucial to creating a new Appalachia. For them, the future of the region relies on lots of smaller industries and employers, rather than one gigantic one like the coal industry. It's a big change from the way things were done in the past. BitSource owner Rusty Justice points to the old-fashioned mine equipment hanging in the building's entry.
Our slogan is a new day, a new way, and it's a new day here in Appalachia, and we're trying to do things a new way.
And as Justice says, it's not necessarily a new way for the rest of the world, but it's new for Eastern Kentucky.
Erica Peterson reports on energy and the environment for WFPL in Kentucky. And tune in a couple of weeks as the Allegheny Front profiles coal miners who've been laid off or lost their jobs in Pennsylvania.
I'm starting to get a little frustrated now, edgy, because I got like 2 months left on unemployment.
We'll learn about their struggles and what they're hoping for the future. They're here. Brood 5 cicadas are just now making an appearance in southwestern Pennsylvania. Actually, the insects have been here for a while, 17 years. They've been hanging out a foot or two underground and waiting for just the right time to come up to the surface. The emergence of these periodical cicadas has mostly been predicted by the warming temperature of the soil. But Kelly Hoagland, a PhD candidate from the University of Missouri, has another idea. Earlier this week, I joined him at Washington and Jefferson College's Abernathy Field Station in rural Washington County. Hoagland led me through some yellow wildflowers and tall grass to a small patch of woodland he's cleared down to the dirt. It looks like a small vegetable garden, but instead of rows of crops, there are wires running across the soil. He's monitoring the temperature beneath the ground and the immature cicadas.
The nymphs are actually, if you were to just clear even a quarter of an inch of soil off the top, you'd see the tops of the tunnels. They've had these tunnels built for almost a month now. They start digging the tunnels pretty much as soon as it starts to thaw, and they're just waiting.
So you have these cords running into the ground. What is at the other end of the cord that we can't see, and what is it looking for?
About 5 centimeters, a couple inches deep, are accelerometers. They are essentially microphones that pick up vibrations specifically as opposed to airborne vibrations, so soil-borne vibrations. We've recorded them actually underground making clocks and buckets, so it sounds like you're just knocking on wood essentially, a little is what they make. And what I'm looking for is whether or not they use more than temperature. They use those sounds, those vibrations that they make for when to decide when to come out. The possible use of social cues. Periodical cicadas are actually fairly closely related to treehoppers. Treehoppers are known for their social interactions. If they're feeding in a group, they'll move as a group. So they'll start sending signals when they're ready to move, and only when a critical mass of them has reached that decision will they move. And while cicadas aren't quite that easy to interpret, they have access to social information because they're noisy little things underground. So they also have the capability of perceiving that vibration. They can feel that through the little vibratory sensing organs they have in their legs. So they have access to all that information about when things are coming out. And it's very important they come out with the other cicadas. If a male comes out too late, all the females have been mated with. If they come out too early, there aren't any cicadas around to be eaten instead of them, so they're less likely to survive. And I've watched a raccoon just walk along the edge where there's a bunch of them and just stop every couple feet and grab one and eat one. So it's incredibly important for them to come out at the same time. Soil temperature can vary a lot depending on whether you're right underneath a tree, right next to a building, if there's a plant on top of you. So if they're coming out solely based on soil temperature, there's a lot of possibility that they're not going to come out with their neighbors. Whereas if they're incorporating soil temperature and social information, that means one might be a little bit too cold for it to want to come out, but if it hears all its neighbors coming out and it comes out, it's better off.
What interests you in cicadas?
I'm looking at collective behavior. So it's not just the cicadas themselves, but how they're informing the decisions based on each other. And I find that very interesting because we do the same sort of thing. An example being with the social information thing. So one's waiting and it's not quite sure, but something nearby is signaling that it's going. It's just like if you watch a bunch of the students on campus standing at a stoplight looking at their phones, one person goes when the light changes and everyone else goes, nobody looks up. It's that sort of usage of social information that I'm interested in. Plus cicadas are just cool, so.
I was just thinking about them ecologically. You know, we know what pollinators do. They pollinate plants. Do cicadas, do they have a function in the sort of landscape?
They do provide a food source to numerous different predators throughout, and they also satiate the predators so they eat less of other things. So you see a boom year, both for predator populations, prey populations, everything goes up for a year. But another interesting thing is their tunnels, because a lot of things use them. Salamanders, there are a lot of species of small salamanders that can't dig their own tunnels. I've seen spiders coming out of their tunnels, using their tunnels. So once they come up, those tunnels stay open. And depending on how much it rains and the soil type, those tunnels can stay there a long time. And both introduce water deeper into the soil from the top. Just the act of billions of individuals tunneling up through the ground has a huge impact on the soil.
What are they doing down there for 17 years?
Growing, for the most part. They don't live a very exciting life underground. Their entirety of the world is this tiny little chamber that they dig out and a root that they're sucking on. At this point, they're about the size of the tip of your pinky finger or the pink tip of your thumb, depending on if it's a male or a female in the species. When they first go into the ground, they look a lot like shrimp. Now they come up, they've got this light brown bulbous body. Their front legs have these kind of intimidating claws that look almost like mantis claws that are used for digging in for holding onto roots. And then these gorgeous bright red eyes. Sorry.
No, well, you were saying that they're beautiful, and I know a lot of people think they're creepy.
Well, I work with bugs for a living, so I've got to find them beautiful. I love it when they fully emerged and you walk through the forest edge, because they prefer a forest edge. There'll be a lot in the grass and there'll just be hundreds flying away from you as you walk along them. And it's kind of like walking through some sort of fairy-filled landscape. It's pretty cool.
The thing that people know most about cicadas is not really what they look like, but that what they sound like. So when they emerge, will they immediately start calling, and why do they do that?
Once they emerge, it'll be about a week before they start calling, because they're very soft. If you start going out for a walk around 9, 10 p.m., probably this weekend, you'll find them on sides of buildings, on trees. They'll be perfectly white and slowly filling. And the organs that the males use to call need to be very stiff to work, because what it is they just have these stiff ridges right underneath their wings called timbal organs. And if you've ever crunched the side of a water bottle, that's essentially how they work. They buckle it and it makes a click, and they unbuckle it and it makes a click. And so they just buckle and unbuckle repeatedly, and they do it so fast that it makes an actual tone. Why they make the noise is actually to attract females.
And they make quite a noise, right?
Yes, they do. Proportionally, if you were to have a cicada the same size as us, or we were to go down to the same size as a cicada, since sound is a relative thing, they have the same, produce the same level of sound as a jackhammer, between 100 and 120 decibels. So they make quite the racket, especially when you get all of them together up in a tree.
Besides that they make a lot of noise, can you say one thing about cicadas that's really cool that people should know about?
Well, honestly, one of the things I think most people don't realize is that they do feed as adults. And so they eat the water-rich stuff from trees. That's why when you're underneath a tree that has a lot of periodical cicadas in it, it feels almost like it's raining. That's actually cicada urine, essentially, because they're feeding on nothing but water. And so they get a lot of excess water. And that's great when they're underground, because they use that water to shape their tunnels and keep them moist. But when they're above ground, they're not going to do much with it. So they just...
They pee on our heads.
Yes, they pee on our heads all of the time.
So look out. Look out from above.
Yeah. And come June, be ready.
Good to know. Thank you. Kelly Hoagland is a PhD candidate from the University of Missouri. He'll be in Pennsylvania through June. That's when the billions of cicadas in this region will finish their mating cycle. After the eggs hatch, the next generation of young cicadas falls from the trees and burrows into the ground for another 17 years. Hoagland says there'll be three different species in this brood, including one which sounds like this. That's just a preview of the sweet music to come. And thanks to Inside Energy for the earlier musical tribute to Coal's Decline. They're a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Thank you for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Caroline Frederica Holdship Charitable Trust, the Park Foundation, and the Benedum Foundation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.